as far as I know, unique in Northern America, or the first time in Northern America. For me, it's a historical moment to be invited to present you a system of existential motivation which we developed in Austria, in Europe, in the last 15 years, and which I was never able so far to present in Northern America. I did it several times in Southern America, but here it's a great honor and pleasure for me to have you as an audience and to step in with you into a deeper, I hope, a deeper understanding of fundamentals, essentials of what is moving us, seen from an existential point of view. I like to structure the presentation this way, that I first would like to give you a brief introduction on the historical background of this motivational thinking, which is the logotherapy of Viktor Frankl, and give just a brief overview of what is Frankl saying about anthropology and motivation, and then for the major time is reserved for the presentation of this development. And I would like to show you, of course, with PowerPoint slides, some topics of this presentation, and to deepen the one or other question and to come in contact with you and to have some interchange if you are interested in that. Well, let me start with the... Something happened here. Yeah. Let me start with the first question. What is existential analysis? It was founded by... This is the introduction here. Existential analysis, the development, and some cornerstones of existence. And then we go into the specific existential motivation. Well, existential analysis was founded by Viktor Frankl in Vienna. It is better known under the name logotherapy, especially in the United States. Logotherapy, I'm coming to that a little later. In the 20s already and in the 30s of the last century, Frankl developed his thinking coming up directly from Sigmund Freud and Alfred Adler, who were his first teachers and with whom he was in contact. This was the very birth of modern psychotherapy in Vienna. But Frankl was not fulfilled and was not quite satisfied by the analytical thinking, and he thought that something is lacking, especially the search for meaning is lacking in this type of psychoanalytic and individual psychology of Alfred Adler. And he developed logotherapy as a counterweight to psychoanalysis. A counterweight because logotherapy stresses the specific human resources, the potential of the spiritual or the noetic power in man, the potential which means that humans have a potential of choice and decision-making. And this gives them a responsibility of as the center of human reality. Being responsible is thought as being the center through which, or the entrance through which we get reality in our hands. And for practicing decisions, choice, and responsibility, we need a system of coherence, of understanding, of being embedded in a greater context. And this is the need for meaning. Without meaning, we are not able to make decisions which are real decisions, that means decisions which provide a certain fulfillment. Frankl developed therefore a philosophical concept of man and introduced logotherapy as a practice. Logotherapy is thought by him as a treatment or a therapy, as the name is saying, a treatment through meaning, which means that in logotherapy, therapists are mainly looking of the lack of meaning and are working about the possibilities where you can find meaning. And therefore, in the view of Frankl, logotherapy stresses the specific human factor. In his anthropology, the human resources are seen as the noetic power, the defiant power of the spirit, as he was calling. That means that we can resist to almost anyhow if we have a meaning. The potential of making choices and decision is deriving from this spiritual or noetic power. I know about the difference of the English term of spiritual, but in Frankl's literature, the German word Geist was always translated with spirit and spiritual, but at the same time, Frankl used the term noetic precise the difference to the religious understanding of spiritual. Here there is by no means thought a religious understanding, but it is a concept which is open to any religious understanding, which is not excluding religious understandings. Responsibility is the center of human reality, and this leads to a need of coherence and understanding of meaning. The center of Frankl's concept of man is, or his anthropology, are two terms which he introduced into psychology, the term self-distancing or self-detachment, which means that through his spiritual power, we are able to take a stand toward ourselves, that we don't have to be that we are not necessarily victims of ourselves, of our drives or wishes or needs. We have them and they belong to us, of course, but at the same time we are able to cope with them, to deal with them, to come to an interchange and to give our personal answers and our gestalt to them and in the way we live them. And this is a specific human capacity which shows the power of this power of the spiritual in man. At the same time, another power arises from the spiritual, which is the possibility to transcend oneself, to another, to something which is not myself. Frankl was calling this second outcome of the spiritual power, he was calling it self-transcendence, which means the possibility to transcend one's own borders. I'm not fixed within myself, I am open toward a world which I am not only receiving, but in which I am possible to act freely, which means to act on the basis of my own decisions and related to my responsibility. Self-distancing and self-transcendence as the basic of Frankl's concept of man. In the practical application, Frankl used the self-distancing or self-detachment as the basis for his famous paradoxical intention, which is a specific technique for treatment of fear, of anticipatory anxiety, which is the core of the treatment of with paradoxical intention, and the self-transcendence is used as the basis for his other method, his main method, which he developed for dereflection. Let me come to an evaluation of these layers Frankl has given to us. We see now logotherapy as a valuable, and it has always been seen as this, as a valuable supplement for psychotherapy in medicine, in social work, in psychology, in counseling, wherever you have to deal with humans and their search for an understanding, for dealing with realities which are hard to support, wherever you have to do that, logotherapy is helpful as a concept of man, as a ladder which helps to understand their own position and what you can, how you can deal with it, and come along with it. It is helpful also for specific indications like in crisis intervention, anxiety disorders, and sexual dysfunctions. These were the main indications where Frankl used logotherapy and practiced it, and it is up to now are these indications where it is still in use and in development. And also a third emphasis logotherapy is used in, is given in prophylaxis and prevention, is for instance for burnout prevention, for prevention of existential vacuum, which is a sense of meaninglessness, a deep feeling of meaninglessness and apathy and loss of interest, which is not yet a real disease or a disorder, but when it persists, then it leads easily to depressions or to aggressive reactions or to addiction. These are the main outcomes of a persisting existential vacuum, as Frankl understood it. It is a good prevention in pedagogics, in youth work, in midlife crisis. Midlife crisis, we understand it mainly as a meaning crisis in the mid of the life, when you see half of your time is gone, and if you double your time, then you are already at the end, and this has been your life. Can it really be? Can I continue this way? And this makes up the midlife crisis. And of course, the older age, when you are restraining from work, and you are maybe suffering from several diseases or so, then the logotherapeutic thinking is a helpful psychology. For a full psychotherapy, we see nevertheless some deficits. The theory and practice for handling emotions is not given. The psychodynamics and biography is not worked through. Instead, psychodynamics does not matter, has not any impact in logotherapy. And this is a big deficit for treatment when you have real diseases which are fixed in coping reactions, and so you have to have a knowledge about the psychodynamics as well as to work with biography, because diseases, disorders, fixed reactions have their history and have their backgrounds. They are not only a weak point in the human, they have their meaning and want to say something to the person, something which sometimes has a personal history which is not worked through, and therefore you have to go back to that point of one's life where it started and where the impeding factors came in, and therefore in our opinion, in our experience, a psychotherapeutic work which is omitting biography is not a complete work. It does not mean that we do it in the same way as psychoanalysis is using or implementing biography. We do it in an indicated manner, but it very often is necessary just to round up or even to come to the causal point of starting of the disease, the disorder. Frankl was strictly against any work in biography, and this was one reason which brought up tensions with our society. Also, logotherapy does not have an elaborated psychopathology and etiology. It has some beginnings in it, and it has some interesting thoughts, but a system of psychopathology is lacking, and there is also lacking methods and techniques. Frankl developed only these two I mentioned. He developed one or two other, which one can say, like the Socratic dialogue or logodrama, but which is rarely used and which is in a general field of talking, which has to be understood in the general field of talking, which is not a specific method. And therefore, this is the main critic which is coming up in Europe, especially for logotherapy. And we took it for serious and worked on it in the last 20 years in our society in Vienna. Existential analysis today, let me have a brief view on that. We tried to work, on the theory of emotion and of psychodynamics. Some of them will be very clear in the course of this workshop. A theory of psychopathology and etiology. Also, we will have some glimpse on that in this workshop, how it is interrelated and how psychopathology is related to anthropology, which is very interesting. That how it goes and fits together with the normal functioning of the person and of the activities. We develop biographical work and trauma work. We developed methods and techniques and have now a whole bunch on it and have it on systematic layers. My wife Sylvia is talking tomorrow afternoon about how they are systematically arranged and how the different layers can be used. The layer of where you attach at the resource level, the layer where you work on a trauma level, and the layer where you work on the deepest layer in psychotherapy, where you work on the process level, of the personal process level. We have specific concepts, we have developed specific concepts for treatment, specific for diagnosis. We treat anxieties differently than depressions, and those differently, in a different manner than hysteric symptoms or diseases. We have different treatments for specific personality disorders, and there has been a lot of work in our group, mainly in Vienna. Nowadays, in existential analysis, we see logotherapy mainly in the field of counseling, which means that in counseling you are not in such a tight relationship with the patient as you are in psychotherapy, and you don't have you have no ego support as you have in psychotherapy, and so on. There are specific differentiations between counseling and psychotherapy. We see logotherapy as a part of existential analysis. It is the specific of logotherapy are the meaning-related problems. The meaning-related problems which arise mainly in deeper losses, if you lose your relationship, if you lose your job, if you lose health, and so on, then you are are forced to look after a new concept of understanding, after your meaning of a new context in which you can find yourself, and therefore. This is the meaning-related problem. Logotherapy is only a part of that. In existential analysis, we see that as an analysis of conditions of life in view of the possibilities, of those possibilities which are worth to be realized. An analysis of conditions of life, which means that what do we need that we can come to a full life, to a full existence? What are those conditions? And we will talk about those conditions right now. In view of the possibilities, the conditions are given facts. The conditions we live here, for instance, is this room, this light, and you have me as a presenter, and everybody has his degree of tiredness and waked, being awaked, and so on. These are all conditions, given facts, and existential analysis is not viewing the conditions such as they are, but we are looking at the conditions at the point of view, what are they giving free? What are the rooms which they give in between the fixed points? So there, it is not fixed what we think right now, what we do right now. We can change it. You can ask a question. We change theme, we change the process, and so on. This is all open, but it is based on conditions. And in existential analysis, we look on this horizon. This was a picture Frankl was giving. We look on the horizon. The lower level of the horizon are the fixed givings, the data, the facts. The upper level is like the heaven, which is the air, which is not fixed, where there is movement, where there is openness. And so we are living always in this type of horizon, with given facts and with an openness where things can be changed, where things are in our hands of responsibility. Sometimes the height of the horizon is very high and we see almost no heaven, then we are really deep in our sorrows and problems, and we are struggling with our life. Sometimes we have the horizon lowered and we have even a good overlook over our situation, over our life situation. Well, existential analysis is looking at the given facts of the at the conditions of life in view of the possibilities, which is the not fixed, which is the that what is depending on ourselves, on how we deal with them, worth realizing. Not all possibilities. There are many, many possibilities. We don't even think of them. We choose amongst the possibilities those possibilities where we feel attracted, where we have the feeling, and I say feeling, that it is important to live for. Possibilities where we can say afterwards that it was worth it to do it, that it was worth it living for it. Possibilities like hopefully our job we are working in, our dealing with patients, like our living in the family, our work for it and for children and so on, for our writings, whatever we do, that we can say afterwards, well, this was a good job, this was a good time, it was worth living it. These possibilities, and this is the human challenge, to find out these possibilities. It's in a sense natural and very clear, and sometimes it's so hard to find it. If we live these possibilities worth for living, then we can say this is existence. This is not a philosophical description or definition of existence. It's a practical, more practical description of what we understand under existence. And I have to say it because existential analysis is using the term existence. And existence means a transgressing oneself into a world, but in a way, transgressing in a way that it lets back or it brings up the feeling of being rewarded. And it can be it is responsible also in the face of the other. The aim of existential analysis, and maybe this is the aim of all existential psychotherapy, I'm not sure, but in existential analysis, we define the aim with a short and easy understandable term. We try to help ourselves, others, to live with inner consent to what one is doing. This means an application of freedom and responsibility. The term inner consent means to take for serious one's own experience, one's own feelings, one's own thinking, one's own inner consistency in view of the outer world. Inner consent means I give my own yes to what I'm doing right now. I can sit here and talk here without inner consent, thinking or feeling, maybe it's more a feeling, sometimes it's more a feeling that it would be better not doing it, being somewhere else, making holidays, etc. And I'm just doing it, feeling forced in a way, then I'm standing here with no inner real consent, with some degrees of consent, but not with a full consent. A full consent is when we are sitting here and having a inner feeling of, yes, that what I'm doing now is good. It is worth to be continued. Or I can stand to them. I can accept it. I feel a yes to what to to just what I'm doing. And this, yes, this is very, very simple, and it is very complicated. The rest of our seminar is going on this inner yes, and on the manifold layers which are implied in this inner yes. To live with inner consent leads to a reducing of stress. It is well captured in the concept of in Maddy's concept of hardiness. It gives this, it's the, let's say the how do you say it, Fluchtpunkt in German, viewpoint, yeah, where the dimensions, the three dimensions of the room come seemingly together. The viewpoint, it's maybe the viewpoint of hardiness, and therefore I think it's a very specific term for describing existential psychotherapy in general, to find out this inner consent, which is not a cognitive decision, which is also a cognitive decision, but which is mainly based on a feeling of a sensing, of based on a bodily sensing of agreement of, yeah. Also, Carl Rogers was thinking in this way when he was very parallel in this point. Well, to come to this inner consent, we have to deal with some cornerstones of existence. What are the central themes, for instance, what are the central themes of my life? I would like to invite you just for a minute to think about that. What is my first idea coming up if I ask me this question? The central theme of my life today, this week, this month maybe. Are there central themes where my life is turning around? Which themes which are taking my force, my thinking, my feeling, themes where I have with which I have to deal with willingly or not. Maybe I have no inner consent, but I am forced because it is a disease, a sickness, a problem which was arising. I didn't want to have it, but I have it. And so I think every one of us has central themes which are changing, of course, from maybe from one day to another, from a week to a next week, from a month and from a in our 20s, a central theme is how to come into a good relationship and to build up to have the learning for a future profession. And the 30s is the grounding of family and job, and in the 40s to get more clear and established in one's job. In the 50s, you already think about your successors and so on. There are central themes coming along with the certain epochs in one's life. But there are also central themes coming along with the specific situation in which I stand. They do not always depend on what I want. Sometimes they are given to me. I'm forced to deal with. But they are, all central themes are existential themes. The question is if we understand them or not. What are central themes of my life today. What do I have to deal with in my life now? It would take us several time to have a phenomenological look at our central themes and to come through to the essence. And our thesis is that all central themes in a life go back to four realities, four fundamental realities. The one reality is the dealing with the world, with how to earn some money, which is a real, effective situation in everyone's life, how to hold one's sanity and health, the world and the body, which is belonging in a way to the world in its, with its facts and possibilities. How can I find my food when I'm hungry? Where can I sleep, which is giving me shelter? Where can I be active? And a good deal of our life is going to get rid with the world, which is the basis. The world is the basis on which we stand. If we don't have a good contact to the world, we cannot overcome. It's a very simple fact. If the world is stronger than I am, I can't live any longer. I must find my way. The way is an openness within the world where I can go along. I don't have to climb all the mountains, but I have to find my way, my openness to come through these realities. Another fundamental reality with which everyone is dealing in his entire life is life itself, which means that we are not only stones, in senseless stones or feelingless matter, reality. We are embedded in a life, and we take part at the life, which means we are born, we are growing, we are maturing, we are getting older, and we are disappearing. We are embedded in a time, and therefore we are always related. Our living means being related. We will see it later on more closely. Being related and having feelings. Being alive is something different than only the different to the computer thinking. A third fact we have to deal with is the being oneself. Everyone is a person. Every human being is a person, which means that he is unique, he is autonomous, has his own will and freedom, which means to be autonomous, and he is responsible, which means that it is not the same what we do. It has different consequences for oneself and for others. And it is ourselves who did it. So we come into the realm of guilt also and of having bad feelings in the living together. Being oneself means to have find his identity, to know who I am. This is also a big, basic, fundamental theme in our life. And we only found four basic themes or fundamental realities. The fourth is the meaning context, to deal with the wider context in which we are standing. The wider context is why we are sitting here, for instance. This is not just for sitting here. It means more. We do it for something which is not the situation itself, which belongs to other situations, to other contexts we are standing in. So we are all dealing with a wider context which is open us our future. Future is our wider existential context, not in terms of room, but in terms of time. And the becoming is a central theme. Victor von Weizsäcker, for instance, took it as central as Frankl took the meaning concept in his existential thinking. The becoming, which derives from one's own activity, which is not only a physical process of growing and maturing, deriving from life. The becoming is the shape we are giving to our life and to ourselves through our decisions. What are the consequences deriving if these are really the fundamental realities of existence? The realities lead to a continuous, uninterrupted concern with them. If they are really basic, we are continuously concerned with world, life, being oneself, and future or context. It leads to an exchange and dialogue It leads to an understanding and deepening. We need to have an understanding of the situations we are. And we need to have an understanding what is going on in the world, what is doing with my life, what's an understanding of myself, who I am, understanding of what I'm living for, an understanding of my future. And a deepening, a continuous deepening, coming to a closer and deeper understanding. In many catastrophes of our life are leading us to that deepening which we are not reaching if we don't have them. But it is like a law in life that we are forced to come to a deepening, or we have feelings which don't give us that inner satisfaction, that we are not satisfied with life, and not being satisfied in life means we are looking out for more and more and for having more. But this is not the way we can come to this deepening which is needed. It leads to, it means that these realities are underlying all human activities. And they are a fundamental challenge of our personal position. They are asking ourselves for an answer, for our specific answer, for our stand, for our personal position. The result if these are the really fundamental realities, the result is that the cornerstones of existence turn into fundamental existential motivations. In the case, they are really underlying all our activities and our being in the world, then we are always dealing with them, and then it means they are moving ourselves. In every decision, in every reaction, we find them. Not always in the same combination. Sometimes one reality is the foremost, the most important reality, but sometimes they are all four together in the same degree. Let me now come. Is this clear so far, or do you have questions? Maybe I was not clear in this point. I would not link logotherapy to psychoanalysis. Psychoanalysis was the historical background. Frankl was in correspondence with Sigmund Freud and so on. Not being entirely happy with Freud's psychoanalysis, he was developing logotherapy as a counterweight to psychoanalysis. So it is right on the opposite to psychoanalysis. Yeah. Yeah, it's standing. That's right. Yeah. 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 That's right. It was just coming up from that need to bring in human, central human topics like term of meaning into psychotherapy, which was not the case in psychoanalysis at that time. It has changed nowadays. The term meaning is used also in psychoanalysis, in ego psychoanalysis, for instance, Kohut and Kernberg, and so there are different thinkings nowadays, also in psychoanalysis. Yes, thank you. Yeah. The type of relationship in existential analysis is different to the type of relationship in psychoanalysis. Nevertheless, there is one common point. I use the term ego support, which is a psychoanalytic term, I know. And in a way, I would say our way of participating in dialogue and being with the patient and going along with him and giving him the feeling of being close to him and not to retract myself and holding myself in a distance where he can project his feelings and so on. No, to really participate in the encounter we have. This is, and I feel myself in therapy like in this way, that I am bearing with the patient, which I'm not doing when someone is coming for a couple of hours for counseling to have some advices or to talk through a problem or a specific theme. More strength to develop his own personality. He needs my face, he needs my encounter, and he needs me to be with him and bear with him. In that sense, I would say. Yeah? Thank you. Right. Inner consent does not mean having no problems. Inner consent does not mean making no errors. Inner consent brings up or lets stand all the problems we can have. But it gives one thing. It gives a deep inner relationship to myself, that I don't leave myself aside, that I am with me also through difficult life situations, that I behave just in that way, that I can look into my face, that I can have the feeling, this I am, May the circumstances be as difficult as they are, but I don't lose myself. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Yeah. In another public paper, I was talking about that existential analysis has a balance between the Western and the Eastern thinking, and it's not so ego-centered that it looks like it could be if you think of. Maybe Sartre or so, that everything, or Heidegger, everything is turning around oneself. From outside, it could have that shape. But thank you for your. I take it as a contribution, which is explaining it more clearly. Thank you. It's no existence free of suffering. No, no. It's to understand. Maybe I can't. In many cases, I cannot understand the suffering, but I can understand my behavior. And this is important. If I don't understand my behavior in suffering, then we have then it is catastrophic. Yeah. Let's take these questions and then we continue for another 15 minutes and make a pause. Yeah. Sal. Yeah, it is difficult to give hope. Sometimes you can give hope by giving a new view of what is going on. There is a difference between the religious ministry and psychotherapy and also logotherapy, and the religious ministry has other possibilities, and we should take. Clear differences. There is also another possibility to give an antidepressant, and so you have many possibilities. One is psychotherapy or logotherapy, and giving hope can come with a new view on what is going on. But also just by going into a grief process, and then something is coming up, a new feeling for what is going on, and mainly this new feeling is if I enter in a new relationship with myself, then I'm able to have another relationship with my world, with my changed world, and this is giving me hope. Having the feeling, we come to that in when we are speaking about the life. On the grief process. Yeah. Well, yes, please.
It seems to me that many times the first decision that the client will make is whether they want to leave this work. Because many clients who are very anxious don't want to experience pain. Or to consider many more possibilities.
Right, yeah.
So perhaps the first doesn't get a.
It's just to accept it. Exactly. Sal, is that? Right, yeah. We are coming to that when on the first level then. Yes?
It appears to me that...
Yeah. We go through the process, and at the end I'm asking you if it's still a burden or if you feel any lust to do it. Okay. But on the other hand, you show you point with your finger on one aspect of any existential philosophy, that life is also a burden. And life is a challenge, is a task, a duty to be fulfilled. This is also the existential wind which is going through. Yeah. One, these two questions. What? Yeah. We come to that. On many layer, on each layer, you come to spirituality. At the end, you end up in spirituality. So, all these four realities, human realities, existential realities, are like four sides of an island, surrounded by the sea of spirituality. And normally we live in the middle of our island, and sometimes we go to the seashore, and then we see, especially when we are forced, we go there, or when we are deepening ourselves, then we see how this reality we are dealing with, world, life, etc., is related to a deeper reality which is transcending this where we are standing. Mm-hmm. Last question. We come to that, yeah? Okay, last question. Mm-hmm. To make it to my own, to make my life, to my feelings, my reality, to my own. That's the task, yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, let me continue, and I think many questions will be answered. Is it okay if we continue for another 15 minutes and then we make a break? Okay. The existential motivations, we enter now into these four motivations. To say the first existential motivation is the dealing with the fundamental condition of existence. Our first task is to look, to develop our ability of being, or to implement our innate ability of being in this world. The question is, what makes it possible that I can be in the world? Or another question, on which do I rely being in the world? What does holding me, supporting me? Therefore, the basic question is, the basic question of existence is simply this. I am. This is a fact. Maybe I don't want it, but I'm here. Maybe I never wanted to be here, but it's a fact. I am here. This is a big challenge. I am. Maybe I'm grateful, and maybe I'm happy, and I love it to be here. Nevertheless, both starting points lead to the same issue. The issue, can I really be here? Can I be with my partner in this relationship? Can I be on this working place? Can I be with my body, my health, my sickness, my handicap? Can I really overcome life, this existence, this situation here, this? Can I be suddenly being pregnant with this pregnancy? Can I be in my economic situation? can I be having this family, etc., etc. There are so many facts we are embedded, thrown into, as existentialists, some existentialists say, or put into, there are so many facts, and they all bring up, arise the question, can I be with them? Can I be with these problems? And can I be with these donations, gifts, and whatever? Why does this question arise? This is a basic in existential philosophy, of course, because nothing is secure. There is no security in life. There is no warranty. We have to live with uncertainty. And uncertainty means it's not guaranteed that you come through. If the conditions press on me, I cannot be. It is impossible to support. Conditions which press in that way on me lead to the fact that I cannot accept this reality. I cannot accept the trauma, the pregnancy, the problem. I cannot accept any longer this relationship if it is pressing on me and in the deepest brings up the feeling, under these circumstances I cannot be any longer. I cannot be in the world, in this world which is my world. The most basic ability is, if I can say, I can be. Being able to exist is the most basic ability. This means realizing of I am. I am here. If I can say, I can be. The fact that I am makes all possible. As long as I am, I have possibilities. This is just being is an ability. Just being brings along the ability, the basic ability of a little bit of I can. As long as I am, there is an I can. This is very important, for instance, for old people, for sick people, for handicapped people. Being alive means I can. I have possibilities. There is a chance. And we have to ask ourselves, we can ask ourselves, where are my capabilities, my abilities, my competences, my resources is something else already. The basic layer is my competences. Where do I have the feeling I can? This brings then along the resources of being in the world. What happens if I don't have the feeling that I can be in this situation? That I cannot support it? That it is simply too much for me, this relationship, always the same kind of problems every morning. I cannot stand it any longer, for instance. What happens? The feeling is coming up, I cannot be here. I want to go away. I cannot be here, this means in this world, if the world is alike. This is a very deep feeling of not being able to be. And if I have, whenever I have the feeling of not, I cannot be here, I'm not really motivated for anything else than for overcoming. Therefore, this is the first or the most fundamental existential motivation. To secure the overcoming, to secure the possibility of the chance of being, to continue to be. If I cannot be, my motivation is blockade and anxiety is arising. Anxiety is the corresponding feeling of not being able to be here. Any motivation is based on that I can or I can be. There is no motivation which has not this most basic layer in it. Motivation attacks, starts with this, or implements this I can. Any motivation is a sort of I can. I cannot is impotency, powerlessness, paralyzation, and there is no movement, therefore no motivation. I can is laying on two legs or standing on two legs to have enough power on the one hand and to have favorable circumstances, circumstances which allow that I can be, which admit a being here. The one, the first, or the on the left side, the power side is the intrinsic side of I can. The circumstances is the extrinsic, the outer side. The power side means I am strong enough to that I can endure, that I can bear, that I can support, that I can stand. This changes within life. Sometimes we are very tired or we are sick or we are depressed and we don't have much power. And so we cannot support that much. And in other periods of our life, where we have much more power, where we feel strong and sane and healthy, and we feel in good relationship, and many things are giving me then more strength and power. The other side, the circumstances, means that I have enough protection, space, and outer support, with the consequence that I can accept reality. It is not so easy to accept or to be with frailty, with own failings or debilities. It's not so easy to have a weakness. Having a weakness is having the feeling of being a victim, of being defeated, a feeling of inferiority. Having a weakness means I have something which I cannot accept. It makes me too weak. I cannot accept these circumstances. Of course, every ability, every I can, goes along with the possibility of fail. But this is another big topic in existential philosophy. But here I just will want to show the connection. If I cannot be actions of protection to secure overcoming, reflexes, psychodynamic reflexes, coping reactions are not decisions. They are not causal copings. They are just reactions to secure the situational overcoming of defense mechanisms. There are always, we have found four different layers of coping reactions, which are the same in all these four existential motivations. There is always a basic reaction. When I have the feeling I cannot be, I cannot accept something, I cannot accept anything, I cannot support it, then avoidance or flight is the basic reaction. I have the feeling I cannot be here, so I have to go elsewhere. It doesn't import where. Central is only elsewhere. A paradoxical reaction which follows is the basic reaction. It does not lead to a good end. Or then an activism is paradoxically coming up, which means not flight, instead the contrary, attack, confronting the situation like a fish which was brought into a narrow. It suddenly turns around and swims against those hands which drive it into the corner. This reaction is still alive in human beings. It's not fighting, it's attacking. It's when you are brought into the corner and you have no way of to escape, then you attack. It is the case, for instance, in the compulsive reaction by washing hands against the bacteria, or running up and down in the room, or making jokes can also be a kind of attacking a situation. Or to demonstrate weakness, like crying, can also be an activism. You do something, you have no way to escape, then you do something. So I know this is just to give you an idea. I'm not able to explain everything in deep, because that would us take at least 2 days to do that. But just to give the idea, if these two reactions are not sufficient, then aggression arises. And this is the type of aggression in when I have the feeling I cannot support, I cannot stand, I cannot be. This type of aggression is a specific type of aggression. It is a destructive type of aggression. It is the type which want to destroy the other, to destroy which is attacking me or which is laying on me. And this type of aggression is called hate. It turns around the question, to be or not to be, either you or me. Both of us, we cannot be. So you have to die, and if you don't die, I have the feeling I must die. That is the center of hate. And the most basic protective reflex is an archaic reflex. I don't know exactly how the term is in English. In German, we say Todstell reflex, death imitation reflex. It's a freezing, it's a being paralyzed. It's like animals do when they are in the utmost danger. We have that too. Here, for instance, it is the you stop breathing. You get psychic and or somatic stiff. It's like a petrification, a benumbing. Which happens, for instance, in the shock. Shock is a kind of a freezing, for an instance, just to overcome, not to move. Hopefully, the situation will turn by itself. I cannot do, not even hate. I cannot be aggressive. Nothing will help. In this situation, I stop breathing, and everyone knows situations where I stop breathing because I've got so much fear. I feel exposed to a too strong power which I cannot resist. Well, fixations of coping reactions lead to anxiety disorders. If somebody is dealing with similar situations, always by flight, then he gets an anxiety disorder, or even a panic disorder. Anxiety disorders are also personality disorders. Confrontation of the situation turns into an enduring, accepting. These are no longer reactions. These is an encompassing and dealing with the reality. What is enduring? What do we do when we do nothing else than endure, for instance, a toothache, a headache, the crying of the children, the perfume, her perfume, or his clearing his throat continuously, enduring such simple things in a daily life costs something, a lot of power. What will we do if we endure it? If we endure the crying of the children, I can't stand it any longer. I feel like pushed into a corner. Enduring means I'm just holding my place, stimming against the weight, against this load and burden. Bearing it as long as I can. I stand it. I hold it. Enduring means acting as a person. I do it. I decide to do it. To endure this. Maybe I have the feeling I cannot do anything else. If I'm weakening my personal position, then I'm falling into the coping reactions. And I try to fly, to avoid, if I cannot avoid, to attack the situation or even to become aggressive and so on. But if I decide, well, I want to go to stand that situation, I look how long I can endure this anxiety, this fear, this ache, then I am decided to throw myself into the situation and to hold my place. And I can come up to the point where I'm getting the feeling I can't stand it any longer. Then the feeling is arising, well, now I'm in danger to die. But before I'm dying, the coping reactions come and help me to overcome the situation. Psychodynamic has its own wisdom. The wisdom of psychodynamics is to secure life. On the other hand, what is accepting? Enduring is the most basic way to cope with a situation on a personal level. A little bit more complex is already the way of accepting. What is the gesture of accepting? The bodily gesture of accepting is this. It means there is enough space for you and for me to be here. I can accept you. Your presence doesn't push me aside. These circumstances which come along with you allow me to be. So I can let you be because I have the feeling that you let me be. I can be means, therefore, you can be, I can be, we both can be. You hear the word be. I can be. Accepting in the basic sense is letting something or someone be, not fighting him, her, or its existence. Take it as given. It is very difficult to accept for many realities, severe diseases, disasters, destroyed expectancies, hopes, etc. The feeling comes up, I cannot be under these circumstances. And have some coffee. How long do you think, would it be okay if we start again at, in 20 minutes, 11 o'clock? So, thank you for listening. We have put some papers, a paper on resume on existential analysis, just for, you can have it for free, thank you. And Salvatore Medi was saying to me that I have to make, that I should make something clear that because in the United States or in America, you are using the term coping for the working through the reality, the problem-solving action. I was using the word coping in combination with reaction. And there are two different types of copings. The coping as the problem-solving action, which is a personal action, which is the confrontation. This is this type of coping. Ahead of that, I was speaking about coping reactions, which are as reactions, not decided activities. It is a behavior deriving from psychodynamics. Therefore, it is called coping reactions. Not to confuse with coping as a dealing with problems. And thank you for this information. Well, I'd like to continue. Of course, we have 1 hour left, and I must be a little bit quicker now because we have three more existential motivations, and we didn't yet finish the first one. We have to look at the prerequisites of that what we need. What do we need for being able to endure and accept? It's so hard to accept realities sometimes and to endure them sometimes. We can ask ourselves, of course, what helped me once to overcome a situation, to endure it. There are three basic needs, three basic prerequisites, which we need to for being able to accepting, to accept protection, space, and support. Protection. What is meant with protection? Protection, I get protection when I am accepted by somebody else. The acceptance of being accepted by my father, my mother, my family, my spouse, my friends, my teachers, is a strong protection. So we can ask ourselves, do I have a feeling within me of generally being accepted by others? Do I have that feeling? Or do I have the feeling that I have to fight for it? To fight for being accepted? Or is that something which normally comes along naturally in my life? Do I have this experience? You see, we are discovering different bases of our existence. If we have to fight for being accepted, we have another starting point than if we have the feeling of being accepted. For me is quite natural. I have made the experience in my life that almost everybody is accepting me. That's not something I have to look at. There's a rule. The more I feel accepted, the easier I can accept others or situations. The more I feel accepted, the more acceptance I have within myself, the easier I can accept another person, I can accept a situation. This gives me a lot of protection in my being in the world. Space. We need enough physical space to move. We need room. We need psychical space to breathe near our partner. In the work, breathing in the work. To have a free breathing before myself and my demands, which sometimes take me away my own breath. And we need a spiritual or noetic space to exchange and to come into a dialogue. We can ask ourselves, how much space do I generally have for me in my actual life? We can show it to ourselves. How much space do I have today to breathe? Do I have the feeling of having so much space, or is it narrow? Do I have not enough space for a deep and good breathing? We need spaces to live in, a house. When I accept the house as my own, it becomes my home. When I accept the land I'm living in as my own, it's my homeland, where I belong to. We need space in time, which is rhythm. My space in movement and time, my own, to live in my own rhythm. A rhythm is giving me a wave of space, repeatingly space, and so on. You see, this is also a big topic in existential philosophy and in psychotherapy. You have here the connection to the body therapy, the connection to the breathing, for instance, the relation to the body, and the body as the inner home I have, the most close home I'm living in. And we can ask ourselves, if I really occupy my room, my body, my physical room, my home, my homeland, if I really live in my apartment, sit on my chair, if I fill the room the chair is giving me, if I take my breath, support or hold the third prerequisite, protection, space, support or hold, there is a big question. What is giving me support in my life? When I have support, how do I feel it bodily? When I have support, I feel it bodily in that way that I am holding up my upper body, that my vertebral column is strong. The physically felt hold and support is richtet mich auf. How do we say in English? Is it makes me upright. Yeah, it keeps me upright. And also psychically, having a support makes me upright. If I have no support, I'm coming in this way. Do I feel my body as support? Does it hold me? Can I really rely on my body? The body is the vital basis of support. Do I have a feeling of being held by a relationship, by somebody else who is standing at me, at my side? Do I have a feeling that there is support if all these supports do not hold? Now we are coming so deeply. We're just pointing at it. We cannot go through. But just have a look at it. If I lose all that, what is holding me? My relationship, my health, my job. If I would lose that, what would hold me? What would happen to me? What would I do? Am I held at all in my death? Or do I fall into a nothingness? This is the deepest and last experience of being held, the existential ground. Seinsgrund in German. We cannot know it, but having a feeling for it, a presentiment. Some forms of experienced and lived hold support. They are big topics also in philosophy and in existential philosophy and also in psychotherapy. The courage. Courage to be. Medi's center of hardiness. The courage means having enough strength to overcome an anxiety. That is courage. Courage comes from the Latin cor. Cor. C-O-R, en français, le cœur, the heart. Having enough heart, having enough strength to beat a situation, to overcome an anxiety, to be grown to an insecurity. That means courage, being grown, having enough support that I can stand it. The German word Mut is the same word as the English word mood, M-O-O-D. Courage is the German word for, the German word Mut is the German word for courage. You have, courage is a kind of mood. M-O-O-D, M-O-O-D, mood. Courage is a kind of mood and decision. I must say myself that I have enough courage to jump down from this rock, for instance. It's Courage, in the courage I'm giving me free on the basis of a feeling. Trust. Trust is the decision to leave oneself to a holding structure, to overcome a perceived insecurity. I'm just pointing to it. These are too big topics to go them through all in this spare time we have. To deal a risk. And of course, trust is laid on a basic trust, as Erik Erikson was describing, and is laying on an even more fundamental trust than the basic trust, the fundamental trust. In existential analysis, we make a distinction between the basic trust. The basic trust is in the relation to the first person's, normally the mother. Fundamental trust is a broader trust, is the trust into the holding structure of the world, that the world itself is holding me, which is a broader concept. Basic trust is a special form of fundamental trust. Self-confidence is a trust in oneself. The behavioral talk about self-efficacy belongs to this point. Hope, loyalty, hope means give up control and influence. The basic activity is when we cannot change any situation, then we have hope. We have hope that the weather will be good today. We cannot change it, but we can hold up the value of a good weather for our intentions, and we hope, and so on. There is also included in hope the holding structure. If you lose hope, you fall into despair. Loyalty has also the holding structure within it. In loyalty, I trust that you are going with me, that you stand on me, on my side. Loyalty is something I can rely on it. I feel hold in loyalty. Truth, the same in truth. There is a holding structure in truth. Truth refers to being. True is what is really given, what is the case. Faith refers to a deep feeling of being whole. This is the deepest approach to the holding structure we can have at all. There are special activities, two special activities to bring in these prerequisites, cognition and perception. Perception, for working with people who have deficits in this first fundamental motivation, we don't look at feelings, nor on problems of identity. We work on perception. What is given? Beware of the facts. Realize, accept, realize, state as certain what is given and accepting it. And this is a circle, realizing, stating what is given challenges my acceptance. And if I can accept a given fact, then I can realize it again more. I can see it more. You have to accept things to realize them really what they are. But to realize them, you must have a hold. And so these are the system here is not a linear system, it is a circular system, a feeding back system. You know, you start in a point, but you are never at the end when you started here. You start and you come back on a higher level at the same point, and you are always working like in a spiral. Perception, just let us talk about what is the case, what do you see. If you have an anxious person, don't talk a long time about feelings. Look what is given, what can happen, what is the possibility, and what is the given. Look at the facts and look at the outcomes. The cognitive procedure is required in anxiety, and therefore cognitive psychotherapy is so effective in treating anxiety, because they don't look at biography a long thing or feelings a long thing. They are important for other indications, but not in the case of disorders in the first existential motivation. Cognition. Look at the laws and the possibilities. Well, let me come to the second existential motivation. We have now the raw material of existence, the world. But now we have to deal with the living factor, the fundamental condition of life, the ability, which is the ability of relating to life. What makes existence, what makes existence rewarding, valuable, worthy, warm, full of life? What makes my being here full of life? It can be secure, it can be in good conditions on the first layer of existence, the first existential motivation. But is it worth living? What brings life into my life? The basic question, therefore, is, I live, do I really like to live? Again, you have this existential turnaround, this turning for 180 degrees. The fact is, now on this level, I am living. I have a body, a warm body. I have feelings. I have suffering. I have joy. I have lust. This is given. Maybe I don't want it. That's not the question. The question is, how are you dealing with it? What is your decision? Can you accept it or not? How do you relate to that fact? Do you go away? Do you turn away? Or do you confront this reality? Where does this question arise? The question, do I really like to live? In suffering, of course, unhappiness, of course, lack of valuable experiences. When one only works, for instance, and has not enough joy, fun, in loneliness, in chronic diseases, in pain. And why does it arise? Life is not automatically good to us, and is not always good to us. We are born, this is the first birth. But now we are asked, how is it for me being born and being here? Not as a cold, insensitive stone, but as a being with blood and flesh, with feelings like joy, happiness, but also sadness, pain, or dark feelings. This leads us to a decision for or against life.
or a neutrality, a neutral attitude towards life. Many people live in a neutral attitude towards life, waiting how life is turning out to be, not being sure, not wanting to intrigue oneself too deep, just waiting, if I'm young, happy and wealthy, then it's okay. If not, I'm not secure what I want to do. This is the second birth, the decision for life. If the impaired conditions press on me, I do not like to live. I do not want to relate or to turn to such a life, to mourn. The most basic form to live is to like. To like something. Being able to live means it. It's a realization of I live. If I do something I like to, I realize my being alive. The fact that I am alive, that I am living, makes all variable, changeable. Living means things are going to change because I myself am changing. They are transitory. The negative consequences. What happens if I don't have the feeling that I can relate to something or to somebody? That I do not like to be in this situation. The feeling arises, I do not like to live this situation. I don't feel attracted nor driven. I'm not moved. I have no motivation, no power to do something. Again, a blockade of motivation. And depression arises. Depression is the typical feeling which comes along with a lack of life. In existential analysis, depression is not a lack of being aggressive, as in psychoanalysis. We understand it as a lack of life, a lack of relation to life, of lived relation to life. Of course, aggression can be a part of that, but in a deeper understanding, it's the relation to life which is disturbed. Any full motivation needs more than the mere I can. It needs also an I like. If I have not the like, if I do not have the I like, defense mechanisms, coping reactions again, are arising. The basic reaction is regression. We retreat. If I do not like to be here, I go back into my bed, pull the cover over my head, hold the warmth, the rest of the warmth in the world. This is like a psychic hibernation. It's a retracting into one's snail shell. The paradoxical reaction, an activism, is to achieve, perform, dispatch, get finished with, clear of, also overprotective behavior, or devaluation. There are many forms, I'm just pointing to some of them. The aggression, the typical aggression here, is not a destructive one. It is the fury. It is a type of aggression which seeks to shake the relation. It's an awakening type of aggression. It's the type of saying to the other one when I get into a fury, you bad guy, if you continue that way, you are gonna lose me. I don't want to destroy you. It's not a question of being or not being. It's the question of having relation or not to that father who doesn't answer myself, or to that partner, or to that friend. I get into fury to save relationship. You see, aggression is not always is not the like. It depends on the existential theme which is dealing with. I have not heard of any theory of aggression which makes these kind of distinctions, not even in Kernberg. Kernberg has some similarities, but he doesn't go so far. Fury is sometimes loud. It can be a short-lived protest. The freezing, the basic, most basic reflex, or death imitating reflex, is resignation. Resignation is halfway overcome by the situation, but halfway, on the other hand, I'm still holding the situation. I'm within the situation. I'm not yet dead. I'm hoping to overcome in resignation. Resignation is not a fully giving up, but a halfway giving up. Any fixation of coping reactions leads again to, in this case, to different forms of depression, and also to depressive personality disorder. The coping or the confrontation, the typical confrontation of unliked situations, the encompassing and dealing with this type of reality is mourning. Mourning is, what is mourning? What do we do when we are mourning? There are phases. This is not the theme here. But the central of mourning is that we hold relationship. We let us being touched by what happened. And then a feeling, we let the feelings flow in mourning. It is important. And out of the motionless death, after having lost somebody, for instance, this motionless death within oneself arises a crying. Tears come up. And what do they mean? What do tears mean? They are a sign of life. They say to me, in yourself, life goes on. It continues. It's awakening again within me. It's a wonder. Tears in mourning are the wonder of life. It's so important to have tears when we are mourning. Mourning means turning to a disliked situation, turning to a loss, not showing away, not having reactions, holding the relation to the death person, to the lost situation, to the lost value, whatever it is. Turning to, the gesture is really to turn around my body, my physical being, my spiritual being, my psychic being, and looking at that what happened, and holding the situation. Turning to in general means proximity, getting close. The natural turning to is that we turn to what we like. The question is, how do I experience this I like? When I do things I like, I'm attracted, I turn to, I step into, I get closer. I want to get closer to whatever I like and to pass time with what I like, be it a hobby, be it a relationship, be it a book, be it a hiking, whatever I like. I want to like time, to pass time with that. Doing things I like gives me an inner force, an inner movement. And it brings up, on the one hand, delight, pleasure, lust, also drives, pulsion. On the other hand, value as the attractive spiritual part. This is the psychic part and the spiritual part. And we have to ask ourselves, which role is playing the delight and pleasure, this I like in my life? Do I really take it for serious? Or do I say to myself, that's not so important what you like, you have to do what you have, what's your duty, or what your brain is saying, what others are saying. It is important to have to come to a full existence that the I like has at least a quarter of that space, like the I can. So we need the I like to come to a full motivation. But it's not the only one. Certainly, it's one of four. The important things in my life, we have to question ourselves, we can question ourselves. Did I like them? Did I like to get married? Did I like to start this job? Do I often do things which I like? The point of reference of the I like is that I do well. The point of reference of I like is my own life. My life is coming through whenever I say I like. In practice, it is important if we neglect or ignore the dimension of delight, of the I like, the germ of addiction is laid. Addiction is a form to bring in life which we do not live in the turned to way, then we hold it from backwards. Prerequisites. What do we need for being able to turn to something or to somebody or to turn to a loss which is mourning? It needs relationship time and closeness. Relationship, the central of relationship, or that would be a whole week we could talk about relationship. The central is of getting getting relationship or feeling related means having persons who are turned to me. This is a basis for inclination to turn to others. Many questions for ourselves arrive here. Do I have relationship? What kind of relationship? The rule is, the more I have relationships, the better I can relate to others. Of course, there are two forms of relationship. Inner relationship, the turn to oneself. To get in touch with oneself, with the body first. The being at home at oneself. With my own desires, drives, with my own lust. Do I have a relationship to it? This is the vital spring of power. This leads to the question, do I like my life? Do I like my body? Do I like myself? And there is the outer relationship. the big theme, the relationship to others. How would I define a good relationship? How should it be? Big questions. There's a rule. Life flows in relationships or doesn't. Without relationship, there's no life. To experience life needs a relationship. And time, the next prerequisite. Turning to someone means mainly having time for him or her. A good relationship is living from the time we spend for each other. When time is spare in a relationship, the relationship is in danger. Taking time means taking a part of my life for you, for the child I'm helping in his homework, for the partner, etc. I take a part of my time, of my lifetime, which is limited, and give this hour to you. I give life to you when I give time. Taking time for something or somebody displays the importance of something. Time means that what I'm taking time, that should be the important. It's not worth living for the unimportant, for the unnecessary. Closeness, proximity. Getting close is strongly moving one's vitality and force. It evokes emotion. The closer I come to you can do it physically. If you get a little bit closer to your neighbor, you get feelings, and also the neighbor. It's like if two magnets come together. It's an induction of life. Closeness induces life and vitality. It evokes emotions. Here starts the existential analytical theory of emotions. We have a known theory developed in the last years. Any emotion is a perception, and that's the definition of emotion. What is an emotion? Is it an important thing or not? Of course it is important, because we understand emotion that way, and therefore we take it for important. Emotion is a perception of vicinity, of proximity, of closeness, and gives me notice about that what is important for my life. Any emotion is an information of what, or about the importance of something for my life. That's the definition. Emotion is the information, the lived information of the importance something has for my life. So, emotion is a necessary prerequisite for a full living. There's a rule. Without emotion, no perception of life. This is a danger in our time, when people want to be cool and want to deal with computer science and just with the factical part of life. If we omit or neglect emotion, life is gonna lose. The deepest form of relation is the relation to life itself. And in this relation to life, we get a feeling of the quality of life. Every one of us has, knowing it or not, has a feeling if this, my own life, has a value or not. If has a feeling, a deep feeling, mostly unconscious or partly unconscious, how worthful, how worthy it is being alive for me. What feeling do I have? Is it really good that I'm living? In my own opinion, not for others. That may be good for others, but for myself, in face of myself, me and my life, do I really have the feeling it is good that I'm living? Or do I feel uncertain? We have an experience about the quality of life, not in general, that also, but also about the quality of my own being and living. There are forms of experienced and lived closeness and proximity like gratitude, love, joy, etc. And there are, of course, special activities. The special activity, of course, it is self-explanatory now, is feeling and experiencing, living through. This leads to the theory of emotion and the theory of value, which is also a big topic in existential analysis. Theory of value in modern existential analysis is based on emotions. Emotions and value are corresponding features. Emotion is the subjective part of the objective of the perception of an objective value. Objective not in the sense that it can be defined objectively, but objective in the sense of encountering the subject. I experience it, makes it, turns it to a valuable or not valuable thing. But it is too complicated for that short time. But just hold in mind, emotion and value, they belong together. And through emotions, we normally perceive most the existentially relevant values. We perceive the existentially relevant values through emotions. And of course, in the talk about values, you have to talk about tradition, culture, celebration, community, self-transcendence, joy, responsibility, sorrow, love, femininity, growth and maturity. Let me come to the third existential motivation. The fundamental condition of being a person maybe I'm lost now. Of being a person, the ability of being oneself. The source of authenticity. Yeah, that's right. And to endure it. I really don't like it. Well, now I hope it is. Yeah, it looks like. once more. It's no, these are no favorable circumstances. Well, being a person, the ability of being oneself, the source of authenticity and morality lies on this layer. Ethics is combined with this. The intimacy of existence is in question. The intimacy of existence. What makes it possible to be myself? That's a big question again. To make my existence my own. What gives me the right to be myself? What gives me any my uniqueness, my being special, my identity? The basic question, excuse me, the basic question, I am myself, that's a fact. I am I am nothing, I am not you, I am not the world. But am I allowed to be that? Where does this question arise? In my appearance, may I look like I do? Am I loved that way? Behavior, may I behave that way I do? For what am I loved? For what I am, or for what I do, or for what I look like? There is a big danger for the pretty young woman. Shame is a question where it comes up. Shyness, self-assurance. Why does this question arise? Everyone is confronted with the fact of being oneself, separated from others, even from the mother, having a known identity, having the choice and chance to decide, and being responsible for what one does. And we have to hold out, stand firm against others. What are the consequences if I cannot be myself? If I don't be myself? If I'm losing myself? If I'm alienated? I don't have my proprium, my own. I don't know my boundaries. Cannot define them. The feeling arises, I may not be the way I am. I'm wrong. I'm not allowed to be or behave that way. People sometimes have for years, for a lifetime, such a feeling deep inside. In the deepest, I'm wrong. I may not be that way. The reactions to these feelings, if they pertain, are hysteric reactions. No anxiety, no depression, hysteria, histrionic reactions. There's a big question coming along with this, to avoid negative consequences, to define one's own boundaries. How well can I define my boundaries? Do I know what I want, and do I say it? Do I say no when I mean no? How well do I respect myself? Do I respect myself as well as I respect others? Do I have the feeling that I am allowed to respect myself? What gives me the legitimization? Is it justified? The defense mechanisms are going into a distance. If I cannot be myself, I'm not avoiding, I'm not regressing, I just go apart or go outside, not anywhere, just to have a distance between you and me if you don't allow me to be myself, if I have the feeling that you don't allow me to be myself. It must can be my own problem, not his behavior. Taking a distance, I'm saying, not this way, not with me. I can live without you. Or changing suddenly the scene is taking a distance. The paradoxical reaction is the functioning. Or the first, the one is functioning. It means activity without experiencing, without living, just doing the activity, like a machine. I'm doing it, but I'm not there, personally not there. I'm functioning. Or punishing others. For instance, I'm punishing you with not talking with you for the next day. This is also an activity, an activism. There are many others, like identification with the aggressor, admitting that he's right, laughing with the others about me, exculpate some myself, wiseacre, attract attention, etc. The aggression is also a specific type of aggression, of restructuring boundaries. That is the aim of being seen, that the other stops hurting, insulting, offending, violating me. Indignation is the basic. Indignation is an activity against indignity. And anger. Defiance. Obstinacy. Defiant refusal. Annoyance, domineeringness, reproach, accusation, and self-justification. All these tend to hurt the other by passing over, intruding, dropping, to punish him or to revenge. And the most basic is the paralyzation, embitterment, dissociation and splitting. Dissociation between psyche and soma, psychosomatic process, and splitting is a dissociation between understanding and feeling, of cognition and emotion. Fixations lead to hysteria. Confronting the loss means forgiving and regretting. The personal action through, acting through is forgiving. What is forgiving? Of course there are game phases like in mourning. Forgiving is discharge someone from his debt. To stop any claiming from the other. When I have forgiven, I don't need anything from you to have peace and justice. Forgiving is not yet reconciling. Reconciling is more. And regretting is working through a guilt, adapt, like mourning. The mourning goes for the loss of value. Regretting goes for the loss of right, for justice. Therefore, it deals with guilt. Regretting is a feeling and a decision and a dialogue. And also it goes over phases. We are doing these phases in our training seminars. We are showing them. It's an act. Regretting is an act of finding myself. It leads to, it enables encounter, which means comfort, consolation. If I'm lonely, we have to make the distinction between loneliness and being alone. Loneliness means there is nobody with me, not even me. Being alone means there is somebody, myself, with me. The prerequisites, again, are attention, justice, and appreciation. Attention means respect of boundaries and necessary distance that I can be myself. We imply attention when we have greeting ceremonies, for instance. Receiving attention means I'm seen from another, and it helps me to see myself. Justice means acknowledgement of being one's own. Acknowledgement of that which belongs to me. This is the core, the central theme of justice. It's correctness. It's the appropriate behavior. If I do justice to myself, I take myself seriously. I take for serious, which means I take for serious my own feelings, that what is coming up within me. I take for serious the mind, what is mine. Appreciation is still deeper. It means taking a position to myself, judging myself critically, and which leads to a respect for the real own, for the irreplaceable, and introducing the moral conscience. This is giving me natural authority. From these prerequisites derive the self-image, the ego structure, and the ego strength. The ego strength is when I stand behind myself. And also authenticity, the tuning to oneself, to live according to the genuine feeling. In the special activity, these are the results, self-image, ego structure, ego strength and authenticity. The special activity is to sense, which is a form of feeling. It's regarding oneself and others in the depth, sensing. It's not perceiving, it's not feeling. It's feeling the essential, the right, the correct, that what is going on over a distance. I need no contact, no physical contact, no closeness. This is sensing what is going on in myself, in others, what is the essential. It's a kind of intuition also. This allows a full personal understanding. And the other activity is encounter, which means, which goes over to a theory of person. I don't know, now it's 12 o'clock, we have still the fourth existential motivation. I can do it in 10 minutes if you want to do it, or we can interrupt and stop here as you prefer, either a little later, excuse myself. Yeah? Encounter, very briefly, is the I-you relationship. Me as a person, in my essential, what taking seriously, what is going on within myself, I present you that. And if you do the same, then we meet on an I-you level. That's just very briefly to say that. Well, the fourth existential motivation is the fundamental condition for a meaningful life, the ability of finding meaning. The basic question, I'm there for what good? When I have no meaning, when I don't see what is making sense, then it stops my activity. Therefore, it is also a fundamental motivation. There's a rule. We are not able to do something deliberately if we don't see a meaning in our deed or work. We could talk long about this, but if you don't see a meaning to remain here the last 5 or 7 minutes, then you can't do it willingly. You may be forced, or you have anger or fear or whatever. The most basic form to find meaning is defined in the existential term. The me being asked by the situation. This was how Frankl was putting it. The question is, going along with this, what can you do with this to make it better, to experience a value in it? Negative consequences, we already were talking about, no meaning, no will. Frankl, therefore, was putting the motivation, his concept of motivation, into the term of will to meaning. He combined the term will and the term meaning. But without these three layers underneath, this concept can easily become a cognitive concept, a cognitivistic concept. So we need the feeling, and we need the I can, and the identity. And on these three layers, then it becomes very natural to deal with the concept of meaning. It becomes a wholeness. Will is an effort, a strain. It's being disposed to invest force, time, to endure hardness, fatigue, to go the way, to pay for something. That means I will. It's not like a wish. Wish is perceive, receiving, waiting. Will is active investment, an active investment. And as reasonable beings as we are, this presupposes a meaning. If we invest without getting something, we are crazy. The defense mechanisms, provisional life without commitment, Ersatzleib, activism. Ersatz life, lust and greed for power, this was Frankl's straining it. Fanaticism, idealization, days, exaggeration and turning all into a play, provocation, these are activisms, paradoxical reactions. The type of aggression is cynicism. I think that is wrong, the way I've written it. Cynicism. Playful, pleasurable aggression. When people like just for fun to hurt others, to destroy cars, etc. Just for pleasure. And the deepest apathy, loss of interest, maybe nihilism can be seen as a higher form of freezing, existential freezing. The confrontation with the loss of meaning means openness to the demand of the situation and to the offering of the situation, to the demand and the offering of the situation. Tuning the situation with oneself, one's own I can, I like, I am allowed, and to the need of the situation, to the I ought, tuning the I can, I like, I am allowed, to the I ought, and tuning both with others and the future. Then I am putting myself into a meaningful context. The prerequisites, we need a field of activity, for instance, a job, a family, an art, an instrument, a piano, which we can play, where we can get productive, devote ourselves, wherein I can shoot like a seed, a field which corresponds to my abilities and talents, so that I can really perform. It's so important for young people to find their appropriate field of activity, to test several activities. That is the meaning of school, to a field where they can test their abilities. A structural context. It is necessary that the meaning transcends the actual situation. It is placed within a wider horizon. We are sitting here, as I was telling at the beginning, not just for sitting here, but for our work, for other people, for understanding my life in the world, even for faith. You have different diameters of horizons. Excuse me. And a value in the future, meaning being directed toward a value. It leads to a value. These are the dimension of becoming. The existential meaning is defined as the most valuable possibility of the given situation. The most valuable possibility of the given situation. The ontological meaning is the meaning of being, which goes to philosophy, art, and religion. The special activity, of course, is acting, devoting oneself and commitment. And here I am coming to the end. Commitment means to give oneself into the situation, to embrace the given, to improve it and stamp it with our signature. Thus we have brought something worthful into the world and contributed to the wonder of the world, of the life, of being a person, and of becoming and being integrated. A wonder where we could be part of if we wanted. A wonder which we could never grasp, but always assist and be a witness of. Thank you, and excuse my being late.